Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, turning our attention to ear and hearing health on the show today with our guest, Dr. Brent Fisher. He is with Essential Health in Duluth, Minnesota. He's an audiologist who helps patients with many hearing issues, and it's great to talk with him today. And as we talk with Dr. Fisher, want to hear from you. Let us know how you cope with tinnitus, perhaps, or give us your questions about hearing loss. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Brent Fisher, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me back. It's great to be here.
You're an audiologist. What kinds of things do you do to help your patients?
Well, we evaluate their hearing and talk to them about safe practices to protect their hearing, to reduce the risk of hearing loss. If we identify any problems, we talk to them about maybe changes that they can make to minimize those problems. We talk to them about strategic communication so that they can hear and communicate more effectively. And we provide them with options such as hearing devices and implantable devices so that they can communicate more effectively with their loved ones and in their work and in their community. We also evaluate patients who have ear ringing or tinnitus and dizziness, help them with their balance and other related issues.
Steve in Ironwood, Michigan, has something related to tinnitus you mentioned. Let's go there. Steve, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you.
What's on your mind?
Well, I've had tinnitus. People say tinnitus or tinnitus for about 8 to 10 years. During the day, it's okay. And when you're doing things, it's there, but you're not aware of it. But trying to sleep at night makes it tough. And also, I actually had a specialist tell me some people get it so bad they commit suicide. I can't believe a doctor would tell me that.
Steve, that's an interesting comment. Dr. Brent Fisher, a comment?
Well, thanks for that question. Yeah, that's a great point. Steven mentions that you can pronounce it either way, tinnitus or tinnitus is fine. And that it's not uncommon for individuals to experience this during the day. They may not be as aware of it. And typically during the day, we're often in environments with other sounds. The background of sound tends to mask or cover up the presence of ear ringing or a sound perception in the absence of other external acoustic stimulus, how we define tinnitus. And tinnitus can be subjective, which is in cases where it's just heard by the patient or the individual. And in some cases, it can be objective. This is somewhat more rare, but where other people can actually hear a sound that's being generated within the body. But during the day, it's typical for patients to have less bothersome tinnitus. They don't notice it as much because there's more going on, and not just in terms of sound. They may be distracted by their work or things that they're seeing or other sensory information that they're taking in. But at night, it's quiet. You're trying to rest, and the brain, which is attending to different stimuli in the environment, maybe is more distracted by the presence of a sound. And so that is pretty typical. We talk to patients a lot about different strategies they can use to manage tinnitus at night. And some patients will find using different sound therapies, like having a background sound on at a very low level. For example, patients might use a white noise machine at a low level or a fan, or having some background noise will decrease that perception of the tinnitus as being as bothersome. And Stephen's comment about some individuals being very bothered about this, is accurate. Maybe less than 2%, maybe less than 1% of patients will have a severe response to tinnitus. And in some cases, unfortunately, this might cause some patients to have severe levels of anxiety or depression that go along with the presence of tinnitus, which can cause them to in some cases, unfortunately, take their own lives. And so we want to respond to these patients and reassure them that there are many things that we can do to help manage this symptom, to help address this symptom of head noise that they experience. And so there are lots of interventions that are out there and specialists that can help them with this.
Yeah, it's interesting. As you were talking, Dr. Fisher, I was recalling my this morning when I got to work, I sat down, I was just fine. And then I was going through my notes for today, and then I came upon our part about tinnitus, and immediately I could hear. I couldn't hear it until I saw the words, there it was.
Yes, yeah, indeed. For your listeners, I developed tinnitus in my late teens, and have had ringing in both ears for over 30 years of my life now. And not that I'm necessarily the case example for everybody, but I'm at a point where I don't really notice the presence of this head noise. It's so universally present in my day-to-day life. But when I stop to talk about it, when I tell patients about it, or there are some conditions that seem to make the tinnitus louder or softer, it certainly, you know, it brings it into my attention. And we want to encourage patients to, you know, to do things from a management perspective so that their attention isn't as focused about it. Exactly. Yeah.
Steve, thanks again. Appreciate your call. Cheryl in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Cheryl.
Good morning. Good morning. So my challenge is my boyfriend says I need hearing aids because I can't hear him when the TV is on or when the TV is on loud or if we're in a restaurant and there's a lot of other people talking or there's a band playing in the background. I do have a hard time filtering out the background noise from the person who's speaking with me. Is that normal? Because I had my ears tested and they said my hearing is fine, but I'm not able to filter. Is that normal?
Okay, Cheryl. Dr. Fisher?
Cheryl, thanks for that question. That is a great question and one that we hear frequently in individuals, some who have more typical appearing hearing, that is that they went and had their hearing tested and their hearing might fall into what we would call normal or typical ranges, and also in individuals who do have a hearing decrease or greater difficulty hearing sounds at some frequencies. And that it's a particular challenge because in ideal circumstances, when the auditory system in the brain is working typically, we're able to filter out some of the sounds that we don't want to hear and focus on the sounds that we do want to hear, such as speech. And you gave the example of watching television or having some background noise, such as at a restaurant. And that makes hearing much more challenging. It's much more difficult for the brain to filter out that background of sound. And that often affects individuals as they get older. It's much more challenging to hear and communicate in environments with noise. And there's different approaches to trying to manage this. One is to be strategic about your environment when possible. So if the television is on and you're having a conversation, it's maybe about educating the people that you're with. So with your boyfriend, when it comes time to having a conversation at home, muting the television or ensuring that you have each other's attention before you start that conversation and reducing background noise, or ensuring that you're close to each other in the same room and that you can see each other clearly. Those are some things that are in our control. Going to restaurants, sometimes some restaurants are louder than others. There's an interesting app that is available through the App Store called Soundprint, which allows a recording of sound levels in different spaces in the community. And you can see some people will have, it's a kind of a crowdsourced app where you can see how loud the level was. And I was visiting relatives in Madison, and we went to a diner on Sunday morning, and the sound level was incredibly loud and very difficult for me to communicate with my family at the table. But I would expect that on a busy Friday night at a restaurant, or Sunday or Saturday morning at a diner where there's a lot of background noise. And so perhaps strategically going to restaurants or venues at times when you know that it's not going to be as loud, or maybe they have made efforts to place acoustic paneling or sound reducing surfaces are present in the venue that will reduce sound levels. In some cases, like going to live music, it's just not possible to manage that. And there are some technologies. You could talk to an audiologist or hearing instruments specialist. They can tell you about remote microphones that can be used, in which a person would wear something on the ear, and the person that you're with will use a microphone. And it's even possible to do that with some more commonly available technologies. Apple has a product called Live Listen, where some of their headphones can be used and the microphone of the phone can be used so that the person that you're with can use the microphone of your phone, and then it will pipe their voice directly into headphones. So there are some remote microphone technologies that can help overcome the noise level relative to the signal that you want to hear that person's voice. But just to acknowledge Cheryl's concern, it can be very frustrating because it seems like in a quiet setting, you can understand and hear perfectly well. But as soon as you get into noise, it can be very difficult.
Yeah. I was thinking about televisions, too. If you have a smart television, just for watching, say, live events, there's a setting that will you can choose that will dim down the crowd noise and all of the cheering and raise up the microphones of the speakers so that it's easier to hear what the announcers or the play-by-play person is talking about.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point. And you can also use closed captioning, too, for television if you need the volume to be softer but still want to be able to read, like, the news, for example.
Yeah. Cheryl, thank you so much for calling. Dr. Brent Fisher, our guest today, audiologist for Essential Health in Duluth, Minnesota. Questions for him? You can email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at your ears and your hearing health with our guest today, Dr. Brent Fisher, audiologist for Essential Health in Duluth, Minnesota. Sarah emailed us, Dr. Fisher, does COVID affect hearing loss in your experience? Sarah's husband lost all hearing in his left ear after a severe bout with COVID last May.
Oh, my gosh. I am sorry to hear that. And definitely we have early in COVID, we had a number of patients that had some reports of hearing loss. And so when we early on, when we were seeing this, it was difficult for us to know whether or not this was directly related, because we will see frequently numbers of patients that come in with hearing loss in a given month. And some of them have had illnesses, some of them have had trauma, some of them maybe had nothing at all that we can identify as potentially contributing to their hearing loss. And so with that, it's sometimes difficult to know whether there's a strong link between those two. But there have been some studies that have looked at this. They're relatively small studies and case reports. And so at this point, we're not certain that there's a strong causal link between COVID and hearing loss. There's correlational data showing that, you know, it seems like a number of people with COVID have also had an associated hearing loss with this, but then also COVID and some associated conditions such as long COVID create a lot of problems for individuals in terms of their the systemic health, and that it's the case that the ear is highly sensitive to changes that occur in the body. And so it's possible that there's an inflammatory response that happens in the ear, or that there's some direct viral damage. The virus can get into those sensitive inner ear structures or into the auditory nerve and causes some damage. So we're not at the point at which we can say for certain we know that COVID causes hearing loss, because a lot of individuals have had COVID and have not had hearing loss. But we know that there are certainly a number of people who have had COVID and then who have gone on to develop a hearing loss during that period. And we have suspicions about the potential mechanisms of that. We're still working from a research standpoint to establish that causal connection.
Let's turn to Sandy in Eagle River next. Sandy, hello. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks, Larry. I love your show, and I really appreciate being able to ask this question for my husband, who has had really hearing loss in one ear since childhood, but he has had tinnitus all his life. It's something that, you know, is getting worse and worse as he gets older. He does use the sound machine at night to block out that that ringing, but he did go to get a hearing aid because he realized the other ear, you know, he's starting to lose some hearing, and we went to our doctor and hospital clinic. They said he had profound hearing loss. So we went to a well-recognized ear hearing aid company, and he did get a $5,000 hearing aid that just made the tinnitus louder. So I'm wondering about a hearing aid for someone who does have severe tinnitus.
Hmm. What do you think, Dr. Fisher?
Ooh, that is difficult. Sandy, thanks for your question. That sounds like a really difficult situation. If I understood correctly, her spouse has a long history of hearing loss in one ear, and some difficulties with ear ringing, and went to obtain a hearing aid in the hopes that hearing aid would help improve potentially, I would assume, hearing acuity, and then with a hope also that it would reduce the experience of head noise or tinnitus. There's a lot to unpack in this situation, and every person with tinnitus is kind of an individual experience. It's hard to really generically apply therapies and approaches to large groups of people with tinnitus because individuals experience this on such a different scale. I fully acknowledge that I have had patients in this same situation in which the presence of hearing loss and tinnitus have confounded their ability to communicate effectively, and the tinnitus has been at a level that it's been very bothersome to them, to the degree that they've taken some steps to pursue different therapies like sound therapy, as she indicated Harry's using. And we have attempted to use a hearing device, like a hearing aid, and it has not gone well for that individual. And so we back it up and look at the range of management strategies that are available. There's not a universal cure for treatment of tinnitus. The kind of approach that we pursue is managing the experience, trying to reduce the perception, the distress, and the impact on the quality of life. And that includes education and counseling, sound therapies, as he's using. We find strong evidence for using cognitive behavioral therapies. So we work with our health psychology specialists here within our health system and regionally to support improving quality of life and reducing things like distress and attention on that head noise that a person is experiencing. And there are also new therapies emerging, like neuromodulation, where there are some clinicians using a kind of magnetic stimulation or bimodal stimulation or vagus nerve stimulation. These are therapies that are under investigation. But there are the point I'm making is that there are lots of other therapies out there, and then also there are important things to look at, like your overall health, sleep hygiene, stress reduction. It sounds like the specialists that they worked with looked at management of hearing loss, but that is also an important step for listeners who maybe haven't looked at that. Making sure to reduce noise exposure and addressing any mental health issues that might be present. These are different things, not necessarily specific to Sandy's spouse, but these are different things that we talk to. We want to lay out all these different options for individuals because it's such a unique experience unto that person, and it's not just one therapy that's going to work the best for everybody.
You know, I was thinking about the hearing aids themselves, and somebody who works in audio a lot, I know that I can tamp down the higher frequencies if I want and raise up the lower frequencies. And in fact, back in the day, the microphones were designed in such a way that they flattened out the higher frequencies, which was why in the early days it was tough for women to get on the air because their voices sounded flatter because microphones were invented for men. That's an aside. But what I'm getting at is, isn't there a hearing aid that, or couldn't a hearing aid be adjusted to tamp down the highest tones that typically is what a tinnitus sound is?
Yeah, absolutely. Hearing aids can be customized to the individual, and it might be counterintuitive. Many patients have high-frequency hearing losses, and so the tendency for clinicians is to try and stimulate those high-frequency sounds. But as you note, sometimes that can be counterproductive in a person with ringing, humming, buzzing noises that are bothersome. And in some cases, patients will actually benefit from a hearing device that has a little bit of amplification or gain for low-frequency sounds. That's going to bring up the background noise. It's going to mask some of the sound that potentially is bothersome to the individual. And so, yeah, absolutely, that's a great point, that we can preferentially select different frequencies and program them to be louder or softer across the range of human hearing.
Yeah, If I was Sandy, I'd go back to that hearing aid company and say, hey, can you adjust this $5,000 hearing aid so that and just give it a try. You know, what's there to lose? Sandy, I hope you'll do that. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And also, keeping in mind the other points that Dr. Fisher mentioned of a broader nature in terms of dealing with it. Susan in Athens, we'll go to you next. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Larry. I love your show.
Thank you.
I do have some hearing loss, and I'm looking at the local ENT. Recommended the old-fashioned kind of hearing aid that goes behind my ear and then, and around and in front. I have been receiving ads about this new disappear-in-your ear hearing aid that was made in Germany. And I asked the people at ENT about this, and they said, oh, people don't like that. They feel like they got something in their ear. Well, of course. But these ads make a big differentiation about clarity of hearing, and that's my chief problem is, watching the TV or in a group, the clarity of hearing is what I sense as far as my hearing loss. So I want them to discuss those new kinds of hearing aids.
All right, Dr. Fisher. And by the way, Susan, do you know the name of that company, that hearing aid?
I think it was a Horizon One.
Okay, something like that. Anyway, okay, Dr. Fisher?
Susan, thanks for that question, and I'm glad you brought devices that are out there on the market now. In fact, there's a class of hearing devices over the counter that are available and can be purchased online or local big box retailers now. The first thing that would be worth mentioning. Susan indicates there's a difference between types of hearing aids, aids that go behind the ear, hearing aids that go in the ear. These are different classes or styles of hearing aid. And presently about 85% or more of the market right now is in what we call receiver in the canal behind the ear hearing aids, where there is a small part of the hearing aid that holds the battery and the chip that's inside there and the other technology. And then there's a wire or little tube that goes down and something that goes into the ear. And that makes up the large majority of the market of hearing aids. And then there's a class of hearing aids that just go into the ear. There's nothing that sits behind the ear. And it might be a little bit bigger. It might fill more of that bowl-shaped part of the outer ear. We call that the concha. Or it might also go down into the ear canal. It might just be in the ear canal itself. Those are hearing devices that we call in the ear or in the canal hearing aids. And there's advantages and disadvantages to both of those systems. And we talk about that when we counsel patients about different types of hearing losses. Some individuals have high frequency hearing losses, some have low, some have a combination of hearing losses. And there can be advantages in terms of the ability to put the device even on the ear and take it off of the ear. So just to differentiate those different styles of hearing aids, one that goes behind the ear or one that goes in the ear. One of the advantages of the in-the-ear style of hearing aid, which it sounds like Susan is more interested in, it's one piece, and it's a little bit easier to place into the ear and position in the ear. the microphones of the in the ear devices are at about the same level as the ear canal, and so we can take advantage of some localization features of the ear itself. The ear is, the outer ear is like a satellite dish, so it picks up sound a little bit more effectively from in front and not quite as well from behind. And that can help us hear a little bit better in a noisy environment when the sound is behind us and the person we want to hear is in front of us. One of the disadvantages of an in-the-ear hearing aid is that it's something that completely plugs up the ear canal. Typically, we might have a little bit of a vent or an opening in the ear hearing aid that can allow sounds to come and go, but it does give a little bit more of a plugged up sensation. And one of the experiments that I've done here clinically is I will fit a patient with a behind-the-ear hearing aid for hearing loss and an in-the-ear hearing aid for hearing loss, and I will ask them to compare. And for patients with high-frequency hearing losses, that is that they can hear better in the low frequencies, but they have more hearing loss in the high frequencies, they report a better sound quality with the behind-the-ear style of hearing aid. And I think that's probably why a larger market share of the hearing aids tends to be in the behind-the-ear hearing aid. So that might be just to give some rationale to the ENT sharing with you that a behind-the-ear hearing aid might be preferred, could be why, if that is the type of hearing loss that Susan has. I don't know. But the over-the-ear, there's a wide variety of outcomes that we're seeing in the literature, in the research literature, with the over-the-counter types of hearing aids. You mentioned this is coming from Horizon One. Some people have had good experiences with these hearing aids, and then some people have been frustrated, and it's difficult to know specifically what hearing aid is working well to amplify sounds in a way that would be most beneficial for the end user. There are some websites out there that have some research that's available to consumers to look up some of these devices. One of these is, I believe, Audiology Informer. That's an industry newsletter that publishes information about different hearing devices. You can look at their website, Audiology Informer or Hearing Tracker. Also, hearingtracker.com has information about some hearing aids. But by all ways of disclosure, I am not familiar specifically with the hearing aid that this caller is asking about. So I can't speak to the benefits of it. But what I can say is that because of the wide variability with some of these online ordering hearing aids, it's difficult to make a recommendation either to say this would be a good idea or potentially that hearing device may not be the most ideal, just because I don't have a familiarity with all of the over-the-counter devices that are out there. But hopefully that gives a little bit of information about the differences between in-ear and behind-the-ear. And then the last thing I'd like to mention is with regards to the clarity of hearing. This is a complaint that we hear frequently. And in human hearing, we think about human hearing as being across a range of frequencies or pitches, like on a piano keyboard, from low pitch to high pitch. Typically, when there's a hearing decrease, a person is not able to hear effectively some of the pitches, more frequently the high frequencies, but it can be also sometimes the lower frequencies. When we try and help people, we're trying to give them some of those sounds back to improve the clarity of speech. So hopefully with a hearing device that's going to make sounds louder, it will, in any case, improve the clarity of hearing.
Good points there, Dr. Fisher. Dr. Brent Fisher, our guest today, to talk about hearing issues And you can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tomorrow on the show, you'll hear about the study of oceanography on here on Earth and on other exoplanets. Then we'll talk about the mission to free stuck space rovers, and you'll get an update about blue-green algae blooms in Wisconsin waters. Right now, we're looking at hearing with our guest, Dr. Brent Fisher, audiologist with Essentia Health in Duluth, Minnesota. It's great to have him back with us. And looking forward to hearing your comments. And Jesse in Sparta has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, Gary. Guys, glad that you picked up my... I've been dealing with hearing loss since age 29. I went deaf in my left ear. And essentially, I've been dealing with that tinnitus for a long time. And my dad is a huge study and a huge fan of a guy called David Eagleman. If any of the listeners want to get into that research... He's a neuroscientist. He does a lot of research on all of this. Our brain is kind of a plug-and-play type of deal. Long story short, I picked up his Neosensory as his company, and I'm wearing what he has for sale there, which is a Clarify, and it gives a buzz for certain frequencies and sounds that are hard for the ear to hear. And with that, paired with my hearing aids, it really works quite well. And I just wanted to give a shout-out to David Eagleman and his company Neosensory for doing that. And then for people, I've been dealing with tinnitus my whole life. One of the things I really get help with at night is brown noise. Instead of white noise, brown noise is a little bit more calming. And then when the hearing aids don't work, if people want a more affordable option besides hearing aids, the AirPods Pro, that's for sale typically in most stores for like $260. Really does a nice job as a makeshift hearing aid. The only problem with it is it picks up all of the sounds and makes all of the sounds louder.
Yeah. Jesse, thanks for calling. Dr. Fisher, comments?
Oh, that's a great point. And Jesse, thanks so much for your call. I think that this new approach to tinnitus is really exciting, and kind of falls into this what we would call neuromodulation approach, where we're bimodally stimulating the nervous system. So a hearing aid is going to stimulate with sound, but there are lots of other receptors in the nervous system, like touch receptors, which we have all over our body, that we can take advantage of to help with the perception of bothersome tinnitus. And so this device, the neurosensory duo, if I'm understanding this or remembering this device correctly, is a wearable type of device where you pair some sound therapy with the synchronized vibration, which I think stimulates these touch receptors. So it's a like a wrist-worn device, if I remember correctly. And some studies on this have shown significant reductions in tinnitus severity in clinical study. I will mention that when we evaluate somebody who has head noise, we typically evaluate their hearing and ask questions about, for example, how long have you had this? Did it come on recently? Is this occurring in one ear or both ears? Is it steady or is it pulsatile? Does the sound that you hear sound like your heartbeat or whooshing sound? Or is it kind of a steady, high-pitched tone? And then we also evaluate by giving them some questionnaire or questionnaires. One is the Tinnitus Handicap Inventory. This can be found online, where we can quantify how bothersome tinnitus is for the individual. You can also find more information on this at the American Tinnitus Association But once we have identified some aspects of the individual's tinnitus, then a therapy like this neosensory device can be applied. And in the studies that have looked at this have showed a significant reduction in tinnitus severity. And so when we give a patient a questionnaire before they come in and then we apply some therapy, we can give them that same questionnaire again months after and look to see, has there been any change for the better or for the worse in some cases to the severity of tinnitus? So yes, this is an exciting approach to development. There are other similar devices out there, like the Lanier device. But I would endorse looking at some of these bimodal sensory stimulation devices for therapy for patients who are not necessarily responding to just a hearing aid, for example, or just to a sound therapy.
Mm. Jesse, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Dave in Appleton next. Dave, hello. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Larry. So I've got two questions. The first one deals with the tube in the ear that removes excess moisture. I think it's called a cessation tube. Mine has narrowed to a point that I was getting ear infection, so I had to have tubes installed in my ears. I'm wondering, where does this fluid go once the tube removes it? And then I was told that after about 2 years, these tubes fall out, and I can have another one installed if the cessation tube isn't working properly at that time. Does that mean that the cessation tube can heal itself after a certain length of time? And the other question is, how many times can I have these tubes installed safely? And then the second question is, I was told that there is a surgical procedure that puts a balloon up this cessation tube and expands it, and then the balloon is deflated and taken out. How successful is that surgery?
Okay, lots of things there, Dr. Fisher.
All right. Thank you, Dave, for that call. And just a little bit about the anatomy of the ear that we haven't necessarily delved into. But the ear, we think of the ear in three parts, outer, middle, and inner ear. The outer ear is the part of the ear that we could see on the outside of the body in the ear canal, the tympanic membrane, and behind our eardrum. And behind the eardrum is an air-filled space that we call the middle ear. It houses the tiny bones that help transmit sound to the inner ear. And it also is where we have a connection with the back of the throat via a tube called the eustachian tube. The eustachian tube opens and closes typically when we're chewing or talking or yawning sometimes. It equalizes pressure in the middle ear. But for a variety of reasons, that tube can not work as effectively. There can be inflammation or infection that gets in there, and that decreases the function of that eustachian tube. The middle ear then can fill with fluid. Sometimes that fluid can get infected, and it can create problems such as a temporary conductive hearing loss. And as Dave mentioned, one of the methods of treatment is to place a small grommet or pressure equalization tube into the ear, through the ear canal, into the eardrum, and that will temporarily act as a pressure equalization opportunity for that middle ear space and allow fluid to drain from the middle ear. So the listener's question, where does that fluid go? That fluid in the middle ear will drain out of that PE tube and out into the ear canal. And most of the time, it will, if there's persisting fluid, it will drain out from the outer ear. In some cases, when there's, particularly we see this in children frequently, when they have persisting infections in the middle ear, we might see a bit of fluid that actually comes out of the ear canal. We can see it in the outside of the body, or when we look into the ear with a special light called an otoscope. And the listener's next question was how many sets of these tubes can be placed, and there's not necessarily a limit, but we don't necessarily want to also be placing these tubes over and over again, because it can create some problems for the eardrum over a long period of time. The tube is, as the listener indicated, designed to fall out after a period of time. The eardrum will, in most cases, heal itself and push that tube out. The eustachian tube, we hope, returns to normal function. It will return to that opening and closing function when we yawn or chew or are talking, and then that will equalize pressure in the middle ear and allow fluid that might be in the middle ear space. The middle ear space is lined with a mucous membrane, so there's some fluid naturally in the middle ear, although the middle ear itself typically we think of as being air-filled when working normally. So the eustachian tube, to answer the question, can heal itself over time. But in some individuals, this problem of eustachian tube dysfunction will persist. And when it does persist and we're not finding that we're getting good therapeutic resolution of the eustachian tube dysfunction, balloon eustachian tube dilation can be used, which is a procedure that involves the ear surgeon, typically an ear, nose, and throat provider, or an otologist will place a little catheter with a deflated balloon, typically through the nose and into the eustachian tube. And then they inflate that for several minutes, widening that tube to alleviate the obstruction in the eustachian tube itself.
Dave, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jerry in Milton emailed us. His primary care doctor suggested he get a hearing test after discussing the possibility that dementia may be in his future. Why would he suggest a hearing test?
Well, great. I'm so glad that Jerry sent this question. The World Health Organization recommends that adults get a baseline hearing test at about age 50 and at a frequency of about every 5 years after, if the hearing appears typical or more frequently as indicated, if there are any problems. And one observation that has been made recently and has been looked at via research is that it seems that individuals with cognitive decline were presenting with higher levels of hearing problems than their peers who did not have dementia or cognitive changes. And as the research has progressed, there has been a stronger link now found between hearing loss and dementia. And so as it arises as a concern, when a patient mentions to their provider that they're concerned about some changes that are occurring, one of the first things they want to do is to rule out other problems. An individual with hearing loss is perhaps missing things that are being said if somebody is mentioning something important to you, such as maybe your provider has given an instruction for how many times to make to take a medication, and then the patient is saying that they didn't hear that or they don't remember hearing that. They want to rule out that there isn't some issue with hearing. We know that there now is an association between hearing loss and cognitive decline, and so we want to try and prevent further cognitive decline by helping patients to take steps that would benefit them in preventing this being as much of a problem or diminishing the likelihood of it occurring in the first place. And one of the ways to do that is if we identify somebody with a hearing problem is to treat the hearing loss with a device an intervention to help them be more effective in their communication and keep them stimulated with sound for as long as possible.
Dr. Fisher, it's great to have you back with us. I hope we can do this again down the road. I appreciate your time very much. Dr. Brent Fisher, audiologist for Essentia Health in Duluth, Minnesota. Great to have him with us today. We'll get him back. And thanks to our team. You know, every day we've got Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins. As part of the team, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau.